Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It sounds like science fiction. Growing a human heart in the lab like you might bake a cake. Or tricking our own bodies into regrowing limbs lost to disease or war. But experts in regenerative medicine are advancing toward just those goals. They're painting cellular pixie dust onto organ-shaped molds that take on a life of their own. Are we ready for a future where lab-grown organs extend life, maybe for a long, long time? This hour On Point, manufacturing body parts and what it may mean for the human race. You can join the conversation. Is this the future of medicine? Are you ready for it? More than ready. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Dr. Anthony Atala, a world leader in regenerative medicine. He's director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine at Wake Forest University. In 2006, Dr. Atala led the first team to successfully implant a lab-grown organ, a bladder, into a human. He's currently working to regenerate 22 types of organs and tissues. To see some striking video of his team growing organs in the lab, go to onpointradio.org. Dr. Atala, Anthony Atala, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
What's the range of things that you are now or are on the cusp of growing in the lab?
Well, you know, we are working on many different tissues. Obviously, we have been doing this now for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we have some which are already in patients, like you mentioned, and some which are now being developed so we can keep bringing these technologies to our patients.
So you're at the bladder point now. I assume that's urine bladder?
Well, we actually have implanted some organs in patients. We implanted the first bladder, actually, in the late 1990s. So we have some of those patients out now for about 12 years. But we've implanted other tissues as well. And the field has seen now other tissues as well. For example, cartilage is now being used for knee replacement. And you have segments like urethra, so we have implanted into patients. And other tissue types as well.
The things that really get people going are thinking about organs, heart, liver, kidney. Is that possible? And where are you on that track?
Well, you know, it is possible someday to get these into patients. The challenge with the solid organs is that they are definitely more complex. And there's really a sequence in terms of complexity. The simpler mm-hmm. organs are the flat structures, such as skin.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly more complex are tubular structures, such as blood vessels or windpipes. They're more complex because they have two different cell types, but they're really acting mostly as a conduit, allowing air or fluid to go at a steady state. And then you have hollow organs, such as the bladder, which have a higher degree of complexity because you're asking those to act on demand. So they're level 3 in terms of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, solid organs are the most complex, being that they require so many cells per centimeter compared to all the other organs.
We'll talk about that and how that, where the progress on research on that is now. One, I don't know if it's a metaphor or if it's a literal description that I'm seeing in many places, Dr. Atala, is the printing of tissue, of potentially of organs, that is laying down at, almost literally by an inkjet printer filled with human cells, thin layer by thin layer of whatever it is you're trying to create or build or grow. Is that how it's done? And for what sort of tissue or organs eventually?
Yeah, that's actually a strategy that we have been pursuing now for several years for solid organs, which, as we mentioned, are the most complex. So you're talking about solid organs such as the kidney, the heart, the liver. And these solid organs are complex because of the number of cells they have and because of the added nutrient supply that it needs.
The vascular tree, I've seen it described as what, like the blood vessels that would run through it for nutrient distribution.
That's exactly right. It's mm-hmm. a vascular tree, the blood vessels that feed the organ. Mm-hmm. And that's actually more complex because you do require to feed so many more cells to get these organs going. So for these type of organs, solid organs, we are pursuing some of these printing strategies that you mentioned.
And how does that work? What cells do you begin with? What do you load into the inkjet cartridge?
Yeah, so one of the strategies that we use is the printing technique using your typical desktop printer. So we use your typical desktop inkjet printer, and we take the ink cartridge, and once we use that inkjet cartridge, you have an empty cartridge then, mm-hmm. and then you can actually sterilize it, and instead of using ink, we basically use cells.
And you're talking literally a desktop printer and a real inkjet cartridge, not some fancy medical substitute.
No, that's correct.
We actually take mind-blowing.
We actually take these typical printers and we then just modify them.
What do you put into that cartridge then? What's the solution that goes in there that's ready to create skin or one day an organ?
So what we do is we actually place the cells, and then we place the cells with a gel. So then as the inkjet cartridge goes through, it's actually laying down a layer of cells with this gel. And then you do this one layer at a time, very much like baking a layer cake, if you will.
And it would just slowly, slowly, slowly build up the depth, build up the body of the tissue or organ or whatever it is you're working on.
That's exactly right. If you can just picture a sheet going through your printer, mm-hmm. you're doing that just one time. But mm-hmm. imagine putting that sheet time and time again and building up on that area that you're printing.
Now, what kind of cells are these? Are these stem cells? Are they embryonic stem cells, adult stem cells, something else entirely?
Well, for most tissues in the organ, in terms of engineering, you can really use the patient's own cells. You can actually start up with a small tissue biopsy, a small piece of tissue from the patient, usually less than half the size of a postage stamp. And then we can take those cells and grow them outside the body in large quantities. Mm-hmm. And we then take those cells from, preferably from the same organ. So if you're trying to build a windpipe, you're going to take cells from the windpipe. If you're trying to take cells from from another organ, you take those cells specifically from that organ, and then you take those cells and you grow them outside the body, and then you are able to load those cells onto the cartridge.
Now, when you lay them down layer by layer, do the cells know what to do? Do they know what shape to take? Do you have to mold them like a sculptor, or how does that work?
Well, once you place them on the cartridge, you're going to program the printer, just like you would any type of printing job mm-hmm, that you do. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, the first sheet, for example, if you take this imaginary sheet, the first sheet you're going to print, a certain area, and the second sheet you print another certain area.
The diameter might grow as you came up around the organ, let's say.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you look, the shape of a heart, you can picture that more or less like a triangle, like an inverted triangle, right?
And yeah.
So, but with more shape to it, of course.
Sure.
So then the as you start the printing, it's going to be just a small portion of the bottom of the triangle. And as you go up that inverted triangle, you actually print more and more tissue.
And do the cells know what to do? If you succeed in stacking them thin layer by layer, now suddenly I've got the shape of some kind of tissue or organ. Do they know what to do?
Yes, once you place the cells in the right environment, genetically, these cells have all the information they need to do what they're supposed to do if you place them in the right environment. As you know, every cell in your body has all the genetic information to create a whole new human being if necessary, right? That's how cloning gets done.
Mm-hmm.
But you're really talking about specific cells, and if those cells get in that environment, they do what they're supposed to do. So when we actually print these heart cells into these layers, once we finish printing this three-dimensional heart structure, which is miniature, of course, it's experimental at this point, mm-hmm. then we're able to actually stimulate those and it starts beating.
All kinds of applications. I want to ask you about the Pentagon investing $250 million in regenerative research. I guess we can see why. And here, just from our backyard today, Dr. Atala, a 14-year-old girl, this is in Boston, Brigham and Women's Hospital, what she had a tumor, and the doctors used this technology to grow a new trachea from her own cells. It says, reading here in the Boston Herald, says they took cartilage cells from one of her ribs, grew them in an incubator, seeded them into polymer fibers, shaped them around a tube like the windpipe, then incubated that inside her abdomen for 8 weeks. In the event, it didn't all work out perfectly, but that part of it anyway. But that's the kind of thing they're doing, incubating a new body part inside her own abdomen to bring up to the trachea.
Exactly. In fact, now, you know, several patients have been implanted with these windpipes around the world. And so, you know, these technologies are now being applied to more patients, small numbers of patients still. But certainly it is the beginning of getting these technologies out to larger numbers in the future.
President Obama has named this month National Donate Life Month to encourage people to donate organs. 100,000-plus Americans waiting for organs. How many years down the road are Americans alive today with organ transplant needs likely to benefit from this, or is this a generation or more away?
No, absolutely. I think as time goes on, we're going to see more and more of these things in patients. And certainly, as time goes on, the complexity of the organs that we put in will also increase. And, you know, right now, if you look at the transplant list, it is a major challenge because we are facing an increasing number of patients on that wait list, mainly due to our aging population.
Mm-hmm.
We are living longer, and it means that as you age, more organs will be needed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about regenerative medicine and the new frontier of growing human body parts, of building organs, tissues, almost from scratch. Dr. Anthony Atala joins us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He's director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, chair of the urology department at the School of Medicine there. He led the first team to implant a laboratory-grown organ into a human, a bladder, in the year 2006. They're now looking on regenerating 22 different kinds of tissues and organs. We've got a very cool video of some of their work at our website, onpointradio.org. You should check it out. We will hear in just a few minutes from the bioethicist, George Annis, who will join me. Dr. Atala is with us right now. And Dr. Atala, lots of callers here. Los Angeles, California, Saad. Saad, you are on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. My question is about long-term safety. When you take these tissues, although they are your own tissues, and you grow them ex vivo outside the body, this is not a natural way of this tissue to grow. Could there be any long-term safety issues, such as possible change in the genetic makeup of the tissue or immunologic makeup, where there could be a rejection, or possibly these tissues can turn cancerous later on?
Great question. Dr. Atala?
Yes, that's actually an excellent question because, you know, one of the concerns early on, of course, was can you, you know, change these cells as you grow them? And the nice thing is that, of course, you can test these cells before you ever implant them, so you know that they're still the normal cells. And all you're doing is just growing them the same way they would in the body, just accelerating that process. And now we have basically a 20-year history of having these cells in patients without having any adverse effects. And that's really due to the fact that our body's constantly regenerating. You know, so for example, if you look at your own skin, you change your skin over every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, your whole skin has been replenished. So your body is used to having a turnover of cells, and it's just a natural sequence, and we now do have the safety profile of over 20 years with these technologies.
Well, let me ask you, in many cases, you'll be looking to grow or regrow an organ that has had some problem. So do you take cells from that individual's heart, if that's what it was, or liver, if it was the heart or liver that failed in the first place? Is there a problem with, you know, just replicating the problem in your regenerative organ?
Yeah, for most conditions, you're not dealing with single gene defects, and that's a good thing because that means that you can actually take those cells from your own organ. So that's for most conditions and for most patients. You can just go straight to the patient's organ, take that tissue biopsy, and you're always going to be able to harvest what we call the progenitor cells, or the baby cell, if you will, that has not yet been developed. And, of course, those cells are normal. So you're actually going after the normal cell population in these organs and growing those cells out.
Now, what about other things that you might regrow? I see here that the Pentagon has invested about $250 million in regenerative research. And, of course, they want to help soldiers with the battle injuries to regrow muscle and skin. Can we imagine, is regenerative medicine related to regrowing lost limbs, muscle, skin?
You know, yes, actually the Department of Defense has made a major commitment to this area so that we can start applying these technologies to our wounded warriors through a program called the Armed Forces Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And this is really a major collaboration of many different institutions all working together to try to bring some of these technologies to our wounded warriors.
But what's possible there? I mean, we've all seen the vets, you know, working with lost limbs. What about the wound itself? I think I've read about their imagining using this right on the battlefield to start printing on new layers of skin right on the bullet wound, like bullet wounds there, and then it's gone.
You know, one of the challenges, you know, right now is that we have a wonderful preservation of life due to the body armors that are being worn. But that does lead to more increased injury to the limbs and craniofacial area. So those are the areas that one needs to target, and also burns. Burns is a major challenge. And so skin still remains the number one need for wounded warriors. And so we have many projects related to skin. And skin is really one of your first barriers to infection and to make sure that you survive. So to actually bring those technologies quickly after injury is a prime priority.
Whole limbs, is that outside the horizon of what you're looking at or not?
Well, limbs is definitely an area of investigation, and a lot of work is being done there. You know, at this point, you can actually augment the size of digits by small amounts. And, of course, the hope is to someday to be able to regenerate, you know, digits, and in the distant future, of course, try to regenerate limbs as well. That technology is not yet ready for patients, but one step at a time, we can certainly make improvements and try to do that for our wounded warriors.
Let's go to Michigan, Stark, Michigan, and Jason. Jason, you're on the air with Dr. Anthony Atala.
Hi, Tom. Hello, sir. I just had a question regarding regeneration. I understand that we're talking about growing limbs and growing parts, but I'm wondering as far as skin. For example, I'll give you an example. If a soldier goes out to battle, gets shot, goes back to the infirmary the same night, do you foresee in the future having, for example, vaccines or antidotes that you'll be able to give to the soldier in that specific part where he got shot, and he'll be able to regenerate probably within a few hours, a day, 2 days? That's my question.
Dr. Atala, thanks, Jason.
Yes, actually, you know, one of the things that we look at in nature all the time, and of course, when we do these studies, we're constantly looking at nature because nature has had billions of years to figure a lot of these things out. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we do regenerate when we look at our bodies. We are constantly regenerating. And if you look at nature, there are many examples in life where things do regenerate. For example, if you look at a salamander, and if the salamander limb is injured, it will regrow in 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, you can actually see a full limb regrow from a salamander. So the question that we keep asking ourselves is, if a salamander can do it, why can't we? Why can't humans regenerate?
How close are you to understanding that? Can we import a little salamander genetics and be off to the races?
Well, actually, it's a major area of study right now. A lot of inquiry going into this, a lot of investigation going into this. What are the genetic changes that allow these types of regeneration to occur? And, of course, regeneration is happening in our bodies all the time. So it's just to try to harness the right type of sequences to make us do that. Of course, that's still very experimental. And it's something that we are looking forward to seeing progress in this area.
You must be accustomed to people. I mean, our imaginations really turn on when we hear this kind of work. And people want to push out to far frontiers very quickly. I mean, is there a line between what's really you've got a handle on now and what's possible and science fiction?
You know, it's an interesting question because, of course, you know, when we look at our history, we always look at things that before were considered science fiction, which are now fact. And, you know, if we look at the history of medicine over time, you know, people were thinking of transplants, you know, at the turn of the last century. So, you know, people were talking about transplanting organs in the 1800s. And, of course, it became a reality in the 1900s. And back to this field called regenerative medicine that we are working mm-hmm. on, you know, when you look at people like Charles Lindbergh was actually also involved in this field. He actually published a book back in 1938 titled The Culture of Organs. That's the same Charles Lindbergh who flew across the Atlantic back in the 1920s.
So that's what he was thinking about when he was flying across the Atlantic. Wow. Who knew?
Who knew? Exactly. So, and here we are. It was considered science fiction before. Now it's considered fact. You can implant indeed some tissues and organs. So I think that it's always healthy to think of what's possible, but it's also very good to think of what's realistic.
Let's go, and what
our timelines and challenges are.
Absolutely. But it's amazing to contemplate and to see what's already happening. Steep Creek, Florida. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, John. Hi.
John, Dr. Tom and Dr. Hoke, how are you, sir?
Very well. What's your question, John?
I was wondering about, we talk about transplants and regenerative tissue. Transplants always seem to be, it's an all or none. Has there been any research about, you know, a person has a diseased heart, as an example. Could you replace just the diseased part and not the entire heart?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, the organ usually works until it loses 90% of its functionality. So it's a progressive failure usually. For the most part, most disease that we see, either kidney failure or heart failure, is usually progressive. And you really don't realize that you're in trouble until you've lost over 90% of the functionality. And so the question is, can you just replace that segment which is diseased? What you can do is augment that functionality to bring it over that 10%. So you want to reboot, if you will, the organ so you can make it go back to 20, 30%. And that's actually some of the strategies that are being pursued right now by trying to inject cells in the injury area of the heart or try to inject cells in specific areas and try to augment or replace that segment.
How sophisticated could this get? Let's say stroke damage in the brain. Dare you tread in that terrain, the brain?
You know, there's also a lot of investigation around the brain area, in fact. And so in the brain, it's a little bit trickier because you're really dealing with acute injury. And it is important to actually try to get to those defects fairly early on. You know, with a stroke, you usually have an occlusion of the blood vessel that leads to tissue death around it. And so that can cause permanent damage if it's not controlled or if it's large. So the challenge there is that you do have to start the treatments early. And again, a lot of investigation in that area. Still no treatments in this field yet, but certainly a lot of investigation as well.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, John.
First-time caller. Actually, second time. First time you guys have answered.
Good. Glad to have you. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was going to make the comment. I actually saw a show about this, I believe, on a show called Brink or Future World, and I was really excited to see it. My fear is that people are going to, you know, try to say this is us playing God, but, you know, I have a good relationship with God, and I think he gave us brains to use and to figure out stuff like this. It seems like it's going to be what's our future, at least for the near future. But I also wonder what the doctor thinks about, you know, in the distant future, like the regenerating of limbs by turning on of genes that are suppressed to regenerate complete limbs and organs.
John, thanks for your call. Dr. Atala, do you feel like you're playing God? Do people sometimes worry that you're playing God here?
Well, you know, certainly any time that anyone embarks on a new area of study, there are always ethical questions that need to be answered. So this is always a healthy thing to do, always a healthy debate to make sure that we're always on the right track. And when we're dealing with these technologies, of course, we're using the patient's own cells. We are taking cells from the patient and creating these organs and putting them right back into patients, and also using the patient's own ability to regenerate by us using specific materials that have the ability to help the body regenerate. So we're just putting in extra substances in the body, but we're really allowing the body to do what it's designed to do. And all we're really doing is priming the pump, if you will, most of the time by placing the cells in the right environment. So we're using actually the patient's own tissue, the patient's own cells. We're using typical strategies that are used for healing. So really, in terms of the ethical discussions we've had, there has been in terms of this particular strategy, no major concerns. Obviously, any technology that you work on has always the potential to be misused, and that's something you always have to be aware of.
Let's bring an ethicist, quite a great one, into this conversation with us right now, if I may. I'm joined by George Annis. He's a bioethicist and professor in the Department of Boston University's School of Public Health. He's author of the new book, Worst Case Bioethics, Death, Disaster, and Public Health. George Annis, thanks very much for being here.
Happy to be here, Tom.
So what about it? I mean, these are quite amazing things that Dr. Atala is in the midst of, and we're all contemplating here in the future. Does this just slide right into the progress of medicine? Do you see a playing God issue of, you know, a Dr. Frankenstein issue here or not? What ethical issues come to mind as you contemplate regenerative medicine?
Well, certainly not Dr. Frankenstein, who wasn't a doctor and used parts of other people, not their
right,
own.
Right.
Not as Dr. Atala does, uses the patient's own cells to try to regrow organs, skin, bladder especially. No, actually, I've always seen regenerative medicine, even though it's really new, as consistent with the history of medicine and the direction that makes a lot of sense for me. I think it should go quite slowly. Dr. Atala's work has been quite slow and has been very careful. And I can't find anything really to criticize from an ethical point of view on it, except not to get the public's imagination too hyped up. I don't think he does.
In what direction? You mean in terms of expectations?
That we're going to get this tomorrow. You know, that there are people on waiting lists for organs today who I'm sure would be happy to sign up if they thought that we could grow them an organ in the lab. They'd be happy to take it. That's not going to happen. I mean, we should just tell them it's not going to happen in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It may happen sometime in the future.
And yet skin already being laid down in this kind of printer style. I see a company here in California. They've got a new machine, costs about $200,000.
Organova.
I don't know what's – I mean, you know, companies don't get into medicine unless they think they can make something with it.
That's
and
for
sell
sure.
It.
Yes, indeed. Yes, a privately held company, too, so they don't tell you a lot about what's going on, but they obviously think they're onto something.
And then there's the question, and we'll come to it. We've got to take a short break here, but, I mean, ultimately, if you can regenerate body parts, if you can build new ones from your own cells, this question of longevity rises. I mean, people often die because they don't have a functioning heart or liver or you name it. If we can create new ones, we get into this issue of, well, how long is extending life ethical, and whose lives get extended?
No, there's a hardcore ethical issue we could talk about. Absolutely. That is a real question. Even today, with organ transplants, the question who gets the next organ is not a settled question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about regenerative medicine and the new frontier of growing human body parts, of building organs, tissues, almost from scratch. Dr. Anthony Atala is with us. He's director of the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and they are doing a lot of work there and elsewhere, but it's quite fascinating work and quite a fascinating horizon. Bioethicist George Annis also joins me in the studio. He's author of the new book, Worst Case Bioethics, where he's warning, you know, don't go overboard when you look at what's out there in the world of medicine and ethics. Let's keep level heads about all this, and we hear that loud and clear. I want to talk more about lifespan and availability and who might get what as these breakthroughs come. But, you know, and you must find this frequently, Dr. Atala, we've got people lined up on the phones. It's kind of like coming to Lourdes, you know, people hoping for, wishing, praying for solutions to situations in their own families. Now, I want to look at some of those first, and let's keep a very sober eye on what we're talking about in terms of timetables here, because expectations and investments of emotion are great. Isabel in Wayland, Massachusetts. Isabel, you're on the air.
Hi, hello, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because I have a son who has a rare form of adult onset muscular dystrophy, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if they're working on muscle regeneration and how that would be, how muscular dystrophy would fit into that.
Let's look at it. Dr. Atala?
Yeah, so, you know, there is a lot of work, actually, in muscle regeneration, and we're doing a lot of work in terms of trying to engineer muscle. And it depends what the applications will be. It depends on what type of muscular dystrophy it is. If it's a muscular dystrophy that is genetic, and that is that the cells continue to regenerate in this way, it's going to be a lot tougher to engineer muscle for that than it would be if it's the type which, once you implant a new muscle, those cells will be able to do well on their own. So there, with these technologies, I think it's important to realize that it's not just the technology alone, but also what kind of patient you're dealing with. And so there are going to be different therapies for different patients.
Isabel, do you know in your son's case what strand of muscular dystrophy he's up against?
He has a dysferlin deficiency rather than a dystrophin deficiency. And the family has been tested, and several of us, both parents have to carry the gene. And mm-hmm. so we didn't know, and it's never shown up in our family before, but both his father and I do carry the gene.
Dr. Atala, does that tell you more about prospects here or not?
Yes, it sure does. For those, you know, for those type of genetic disorders where you do have that type of a defect, you really would need to modify the cells genetically before you put them in, or modify the cells in some fashion before you put them back in. And so the strategies there would be, you know, more genetic in combination with regenerative medicine as opposed to just regenerative medicine alone. And a lot of work being done. For example, there's the FRACE Foundation that's doing work similar to that. That's FRASC Foundation. That's really looking at the combination of genetics and regenerative medicine. So this is certainly something that we've been working with them, with that particular foundation on, and there's a lot of work being done.
Is there a time horizon on this one of, you know, 5 years, 10, who knows?
You know, it's hard to predict, and that's why we never really like to predict the timelines, because you never know. You never know how research goes, and like was just mentioned a little bit earlier by George, we have to be careful, and we do follow that strategy of being careful with these technologies to make sure that we do all the research and that we keep the expectations where they need to be. So it's hard to predict. All we can say is that, you know, we're working on these technologies, and time will tell when these technologies are really ready for patients.
Isabel, good luck to your son. George Annis, there's an ethics here of expectations, among other things. I mean, people's hearts and health are really on the line here.
Absolutely.
Emotional.
No, there's no question when you or even more your family member has a disease or illness or injury, you will do literally anything you can to try to help them. And when what we have available now in medicine can't help them, there's absolutely a very natural instinct to go look for anything, even though it's highly experimental, even though it's never been tried in humans. Mm-hmm. Many people would still be willing to try it, at least if it's not going to make the situation worse. No one really wants to put their loved one at risk of being worse off.
And you don't want to lead people to think this is coming tomorrow morning when who knows when it's coming.
Well,
exactly.
Absolutely, or if it's ever going to come at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, we hope it's going to come, but yes.
Marilyn in Warrensburg, New York. Marilyn, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have Turk-Strauss vasculitis, which is an autoimmune disorder caused by overproduction of eosinophil. And my question is whether there's anything in the future about being able to treat this type of bone marrow-related autoimmune disorder with any kind of, well, for the sake of this discussion, transplant.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Atala?
Yes, actually, that brings an interesting point, which is that if you do have autoimmune disorders like the one that you mentioned, and other autoimmune disorders as well, just to regenerate an organ itself is not sufficient, right? Because if we do regenerate the tissue or structure that you need, At the end of the day, if we don't control the autoimmune disorder, the condition that's actually causing the problem, mm-hmm. then that engineered organ is going to go through the same challenges.
Right.
And so that is really a two-step strategy for that, which is to try to figure out the actual condition and make sure that that can be controlled, you know, with research in that specific area before you are able to bring these engineered tissues and organs into the equation.
Now, to do that, are you saying you can't use cells necessarily from the whatever organ or bone marrow in this case that has autoimmune deficiency? Do you have to go back to stem cells? Does that bring embryonic stem cells into play? You know, sort of pre-problem cells, if that's not too crude a description.
Well, what the autoimmune disorder is actually your own body fighting your own tissue. So what happens is that something is not right in terms of your immunity. You know, the same things that provide you the defenses for outside mm-hmm. things that come into your body, it actually has turned against your own body.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cells are fine. The cells which are in your body are fine, but they get attacked by your own body. So you can still take those cells from the patient
mm-hmm.
And create the organ, and you can create a new organ with it. But you have, before you put it back in, you need to make sure that the problem of you fighting your own organ goes away.
Let's get a call from Nina in Boston. Hi, Nina. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was listening to the segment about being able to perhaps eventually regenerate limbs for soldiers who've been injured.
Yes.
And I do research in congenital anomalies in newborns, studies of birth defects. And I was wondering, for infants who have some kind of congenital malformation, for instance, a missing limb at birth, is there ever going to be the potential for any kind of in utero therapeutic regenerative medicine that can be used even before birth?
Wow. Okay. That's an amazing notion. What about it, Dr. Tala?
Yeah, actually, we have been doing a lot of work in that area now for some time. The concept there is that if you do detect the defect before the baby's born, is it possible then to take cells from some source and actually create the tissue and structure so you have it ready at the time of birth? And actually, we did a lot of investigation in that area by, for example, you can actually take the amniotic fluid. That's the fluid that surrounds the developing baby in the
mm-hmm.
womb.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, moms come in to do an amniocentesis. That is where they take the amniotic fluid. So
right.
There are many moms who have that procedure done while they're pregnant. So you can actually, if you get an ultrasound before birth and you do see in the womb a defect, you can actually take the amniotic fluid that's being used for diagnostic purposes, and you can actually take that fluid and actually get a cell population, a stem cell population from the fluid that comes from the same baby. And then you can actually go and create these cells. You can grow the tissue specifically for that that fetus that's in the mother's womb and have that tissue ready at the time of birth.
So, but it wouldn't be an in utero intervention. Let's say the baby's, I don't know, has some kind of deformation and missing an arm, let's say.
You know, the in utero intervention is interesting. As you know, there is in utero intervention right now, but it's fairly limited and it's high risk. So it has to be something that really will make a difference. And we actually have done experimental models where we actually take tissue from the baby, from the developing fetus itself. So actually, some of the early work that we did a few years ago, we demonstrated that you could actually take tissue experimentally, of course. You can take tissue while the fetus is being developed, and then you can actually create the tissue and have it ready for the baby and intervene. But, you know, the problem there is that, you have such a high risk of losing the baby with a utero intervention.
Right, right.
That you have to really, you know, again, that's where you get into those decisions of what's going to be best long term.
I notice I've raised embryonic stem cells a few times. You never really pick up on it. I suppose I couldn't blame you. There was so much controversy a few years ago when it was out there. But I saw just this week that the National Institutes of Health announced on Tuesday that 13 additional lines of human embryonic stem cells are going to be eligible for federal funding. Does that matter to your field of regenerative medicine? Is that still important? Key, we were told it was vital not so long ago.
Well, you know, they're vital cells for research. But what we're doing at the Institute here is really trying to get technologies to patients to therapy. And so we try to use cells that are going to benefit the patient best at the time. And when you're talking about cells that come from other sources that don't come from the patient, whether they be embryonic or other type of stem cells, that you're going to be dealing with a challenge, which is rejection.
Mm-hmm.
Because those cells are coming genetically from a different source.
Mm-hmm.
So when you create those cells and put them back into a patient, now you have to deal also with the rejection challenges. So for that reason, from a clinical standpoint, and what you want to do best for the patient is really try to, if at all possible, use the patient's own cells.
What, the longevity question, if you're able to regenerate enough, presumably many of the causes of death will be at least certainly delayed by regeneration. Are you talking... And I know there are many more factors than just particular organs at play here, but are you talking extending human life potentially for people who could come in and slap in one new organ after another? I mean, I see you quoted saying here, I foresee a future when organs will be available off the shelf, ready to plug in and replace injured or diseased organs. Does that mean we're going to live to 120, 150, 200?
Well, I think if you take all the changes that are going on right now, I mean, if you look at life expectancy, I mean, it is amazing to see that in the early 1900s, life expectancy was only about 30 years, the average life expectancy.
In the early 1900s, only a century ago?
That's right. Only a century ago. And within just a few decades, they were able to double the life expectancy to over 60 years, only within a few decades. And now, life expectancy right now is over 80.
So are we heading for 160?
So, well, I think that many factors go into it. You know, the quality of life, the health that you receive, nutrition, and all the elements about preventive medicine, which are so important, those are all contributing to the lengthening of our life expectancy. And I believe that, you know, regenerative medicine is just one piece of the equation. But if you can actually provide an organ rather than be on dialysis for several years, certainly that will increase your life expectancy as well.
Dr. Annis, you're listening very patiently to. I just wonder what's running through your ethicist's mind as you listen to the questions we're getting from our callers lining up, you know, dreaming of, hoping for cures, of the talk of what looks like hyper longevity from our time now, potentially here, of another doubling maybe of lifespans.
Well, lifespan has been going up. It's been increasing, believe it or not, 7 hours every day for the last 100 years.
Even Americans? I read recently it turned down with our obesity issues.
I think obesity may be overhyped, but mm-hmm. But the real limiting factor seems to be the brain, and that not many people want to continue to live, even with a very healthy body, when they have a severe Alzheimer's disease, for example, or any of the dementias. And, you know, so an extra 10 years in a nursing home is not something anyone
let alone 50.
So, you know, replace organs like people with kidney failure who are otherwise healthy or heart failure, that's a great future to look forward to. But living indefinitely with a healthy body and a diseased or non-functioning brain, I don't think is anyone's idea of a walk in the park here.
And the issue of who gets what in the American health system as we know it, and maybe on the path where it's headed, and who knows where that is exactly, as Dr. Atala and his colleagues come up with these regenerative solutions, who do you think is going to be, you know, what kind of tilt will we have in our system? Who's going to get them? People with money? People with insurance? Will insurance cover this?
Well, those are good questions. People with money will always get whatever is available. Will insurance cover it? Should insurance cover it? Well, we're having this debate right now. We're barely having the debate, but we will be because medicine is so expensive. And that will be answered on some kind of cost-effectiveness, cost-benefit analysis basis. Is it worth it? What's worth it? Worth it to who? It's always going to be worth it to the patient, probably. But for insurance, we're going to ask, is it worth it to society?
For heart transplant, for example, Dr. Atala, right now the cost of that is someone dying in part produces that heart. But then, of course, there are costs with transporting it and so on. if you compare costs here, you know, looking out, what do you anticipate? Will a regenerative medicine creation, a heart that you make in the lab, be more or less expensive than a transplant?
No, these technologies are definitely more expensive. I mean, you know, you're talking about personalized medicine. So it does change the paradigm. You know, for example, a patient on dialysis who has kidney failure, who has to be hooked up to a machine three times per week, that patient it's estimated that it's costing our healthcare system about $250,000 per patient.
What about a new kidney there that you create?
So the thing is how can you actually generate these technologies? Probably will be expensive. You're probably talking about an organ that's going to cost, you know, $50,000-$100,000 to create, but you're saving that patient first in the most important thing, their quality of life, and second, of course, saving the healthcare system an extra, at $250,000 recurring cost every year. But we have to be cautious. I mean, when we talk about these things, we have to be cautious and realistic to make sure that people understand that these are not things that are coming down the pipeline tomorrow. And I think that's why, you know, we have to continue to work in these technologies carefully and be able to manage these expectations.
Curtain coming up, though, on quite a fascinating future, and we're grateful for the glimpse you've given us today. Dr. Anthony Atala at the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, thank you very much for joining us today. And George Annis, author of Worst Case Bioethics. Dr. Annis, thanks very much for coming in.
Welcome.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.